Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
Hi, Aaron. My name is Bill Cundiff.
Did you think I was going to forget?
Oh, no. No. I thought you were right on target. No worries. Hey, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pape is located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard up in Shasta Lake City, right off I-5. And you could see them for John Deere tractors, mowers, implements. Go in and see them. They got it all going on up there. They got Honda generators, steel products, full line, full service. Give them a call, 226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
So, let's see. Today is April 25th, 2021, just in case we replay this and we say something that's, I don't know, date specific. I know sometimes I play things after the fact, and I guess the worst one was when we had changed presidents. We played something from during the Obama administration, during the Trump administration. People are like, you can't say that about the president. They're all mad. Like, I guess we just didn't.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, word to the wise. Use their name. Don't call them just the president, huh? But the president right now is a... kind of a numbskull, so we're back to that again. We could replay all those Obama shows, and everything we said would be accurate.
The good news is he doesn't know he's a numbskull.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And no matter how many times people tell him that, doesn't matter. So we're getting a little rain today, which is kind of nice, and we can only cross all of our little fingers that the Bureau of Reclamation doesn't waste it all before our farmers have a chance to use it. That would be something I would...
The fish are going to make it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kill the fish. I'm about ready to start like a new campaign. Well, I'm ready for my Edible Species Act, actually.
Yeah.
The new ESA, the Edible Species Act, where if we can't eat it, we don't need it.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used it on the signature line of my email. I got a lot of hate for that.
Throwing down the hate.
I don't know why. I thought it was kind of funny. And sort of true.
Yeah.
People are sick of the stupid Endangered Species Act ruining everyone's life. So
I'm going to go buy some Chinook salmon, I think, today.
And throw it away?
No, I think I'll smoke it.
Nice. I like that. So we have two really fun guests for you today. And I don't know. Fun's probably the wrong word. We're using fun in the sense that you'll like them. You will like them and you'll learn things. How about that? That's our kind of fun. So the first hour, we're going to talk about the China's historic persecution of the Falun Gong. We've spoken to you a lot about the...
organ harvesting.
Yes, thank you. The forced organ harvesting and the Falun Gong are really the... They were the original... Well, I shouldn't say original. I don't know that. But they're really the target, a big target of political persecution over there in China. You hear a lot about the Uyghurs, but the Falun Gong were... being brutalized long before that. And our guest, Dr. Shezong Chen, has a tremendous amount of information there. Second hour, just to give you a little clue there, the dictatorship of woke capital, which I think you'll like. He has, Stephen Sokup has written a book, and I think you will find that interesting. So we're going to switch it up today and do two different things. So Dr. Chen has been on with us before. I would encourage you to go back and listen to previous shows on China. We have a tab at the top of the page marked China for your easy review. You can go back and learn all sorts of things. We won't be recapping everything because obviously that's too hard. But Dr. Chen's been active in projects concerning China for over 30 years. He's founded, co-founded, or been spokesperson for a number of organizations concerning China and has spoken extensively on issues related. He began his activism in 1989 when he helped organize supporting activities during the 1989 Beijing student movement. He was outraged by the June 4th massacre, and he founded the Tiananmen Square Foundation. He served on the board of the Press Freedom Guardian and was elected vice president of the Independent Federation of Chinese Students and Scholars in the U.S. And At 15, he entered the gifted program at China University Science and Technology. Then he came to the U.S. That's how he wound up here. And in 1982 to study and receive his PhD in molecular biology at the University of California, San Diego. And he currently owns and runs a molecular biology startup in San Diego. So there's more about him on the web. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us. So, I could take a breath now.
There you go.
I'm coming up for air. Hi, Dr. Welcome. Chen.
Welcome, Dr. Chen. Nice talking to you again.
Nice to be back, and thank you for having me today.
Sure.
For this historical date. Back in 1999, April 25th, peaceful petition, was a event that covered widely by international media for a different reason than later. Later, the April 25th peaceful petition or demonstration, more petition, was reported positively. And many news media, now you look back, they're in the habit of finding positive things to say about the Chinese government. So at that time, it was no different. The April 25th petition was praised by international media for the Chinese government's rationale, resolution, or dialogue on that event and peacefully ending that petition. So that was then. But after July 20th and until now, international media now attribute that peaceful petition. They now leave the peaceful out. Now they attribute the persecution of the CCP of Falun Gong to that gathering by over 10,000 Falun Gong practitioners. So I need to point this out first. Before Falun Gong, it was historical. For me, it's very personal. And so why Falun Gong is why the April 25th petition is historical? First of all, it is a unprecedented peaceful petition by Chinese people under the CCP for spiritual freedom. Now, there are other peaceful demonstration petitions, but for spiritual freedom, this was the first under CCP, right? And for actually ever, right? Because before CCP, the Chinese people never need to petition for spiritual freedom. Or if we use the language in English, let's say, in other language, it would be for religious freedom. But really, it's for Chinese people, it's a spiritual freedom. It's a petition for them, for those who are there, is to petition for the right to be pious, to be moral, to be good people. And if we think about it now, it's actually for the right to be left alone and for the right of conscience.
Can you tell us why that is? Why is that such a big threat to them? To the CCP?
Because those are the things that we cannot afford to give people. And if we are not careful, this may be the things that our own government cannot afford to give us. Right. But we'll come back to that later. I'll talk more about that for sure. And then the second reason it was historical is because the April 25th, as we know now, it was an set up by the CCP at that time, okay, and used as an excuse by Jiang Zemin, the head of the CCP at that time, to persecute Falun Gong. And he was successful because international, as I say, international media still use that event as a reason to explain away the CCP's persecution of Falun Gong. And then, if we have time, then I would like to say a few words about what has happened since then, the significance to what's happening around the world, particularly in the United States. And I want to share a little bit of my personal experience about April 25th. There are plenty of articles talk about the participants of the peaceful petition, their experience. I am actually a benefactor of that event. I was in a Falun Gong petition at that time, so I was a bystander observer, half a globe away. I was in the United States, but that event impacted me and actually changed my life completely. So on the morning of April 25th, I received an email from a friend, democracy activist. So, as Aaron mentioned earlier, that I have been actively participating in pro-democracy activist activities to support freedom in China. And so I was very active in that, and I originally placed the hope of China on democracy. But towards 1990s, I began to lose my hope because I saw that China's main issue is no longer whether it's a democratic. And the problem are also not solvable by democracy, but rather is a destruction of morality and destruction of environment. So I become disillusioned and become desperate. And the only hope that I have at that time was hope itself. Now, this is maybe hard to explain, because I see no hope, but I still hold out a hope. Somewhere there may be a hope. When people can see that hope, maybe they will pick up their confidence, see the hope in China. And that was me. And I see a lot of people like that, like me. But where the hope? I don't see any hope at that time, right? So I become less and less active in terms of pro-democracy activists, but I still have a connection with that group. So this was the email from that group. We have a circle of pro-democracy activists. And in that email, a friend of mine asked, anybody heard about Falun Gong? And he said, over 10,000 Falun Gong practitioners stage a petition in front of the Chinese government or the CCP headquarters. And I didn't care at that time. I didn't pay attention because I thought, who cares? with how badly things were. 10,000 people, 100,000 people, a million people, anywhere to have a petition, I wouldn't be surprised. Right? And then the next day, many English media start to cover this. And then looking at a picture, a friend of mine said, oh, this is not a regular petition. Because you look at a picture, the people line up, they're orderly, and they're not youngsters. They're not students. They are like in their 50s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And those have family. So this is not a regular petition.
Hold that thought, Dr. Chen. I hate to interrupt right in the middle. We have to take a really quick break, and we'll come right back. Our guest is Dr. Shezong Chen. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
And I should remind you that we have archives that stretch back like 10 years. So if you go to the website, you can listen to all of those free of charge, and they are also commercial free. So save you some time, and you can learn some new stuff. All right, Dr. Chen. I think that you were describing what I think everyone would say is actually a peaceful protest.
It's a peaceful protest, but then it was an appeal just tell the government to leave them alone, to give them the freedom of the right to be moral, spiritual freedom. So anyway, so I'll continue on how I came to know Falun Gong since because of that. So that weekend, several of us, friend, we went to a Chinese market for shopping, and there I saw a post about Falun Gong, and then on the post it says truth, benevolence, and forbearance. And this was the third time I came across the idea or the word of Falun Gong. The first time was, of course, on April 25th, and then the international media report. And this is the third time, but this is the first time I saw three words, truth, benevolence, and forbearance. And supposedly, these are the principles of Falun Gong. And I thought, and I didn't think much about forbearance or tolerance at that time. I said, well, given how much I know about CCP, the destruction it has done to my country, I just didn't have the way to do it. If I had a way to do it, I'll bring in, you know, whatever, a bomb or a AK-47 and go to the CCP headquarters to throw out all those bastards. So I didn't care about benevolence at that time, but still, I was curious enough to bought, because there was a Chinese newspaper at the Chinese supermarket. So I went to the newspaper stand and bought all issues that that has the three words of Falun Gong in them. And so I start right away. And what shocked me first is about the Falun Gong itself, that the founder of Falun Gong, Mr. Li Hongzhi, required his disciples, ask his disciples to be good person, to be a moral person. And there were 100 million Chinese people practicing Falun Gong. With my understanding at that time about the Chinese society, this was just complete the opposite of my perception, my understanding at that time, because I thought at that time if there were people in Beijing teaching people how to cheat, rob, kill, I have no problem imagining 100 million people following him to learn that. But to teach people to be moral, to be self-disciplined, it was out of my imagination. But then I read those reports in Houston, in Taiwan, in New York, in other places. So many Falun Gong practitioners are doing volunteer work to teach others to be good people, to teach others about Falun Gong, to donate money to good causes. And to me, those were not what I understood at that time about Chinese people. And, of course, then some obviously is also true, because many reporters, Chinese reporters, they try to rationalize about this. They say, okay, the reason Falun Gong becomes so popular with, you know, all this is because it's very pragmatic. Because Falun Gong is free of charge. And the practice Falun Gong will help people to get rid of disease. They would heal the illness, right? And I didn't buy that. Because, yes, it's pragmatic to cure illness. But it's not at all pragmatic to donate money for public affairs, to public wellness, to good causes, right? And with so many people voluntarily telling other people or teaching other people about exercise, you know, it would be very strange, or it would be very difficult to maintain the same. You know, if you teach one person, you will deviate a little bit, and then the next one, you'll deviate a little bit. And then I was curious, how when this starts from one person to 100 million people without it being deviated in one way or another. And then I also read about state interviewed so many people who went to Beijing to participate in the petition, because April 25th is dangerously close to June 4th, an event that the CCP is very sensitive to and use all forces to suppress. Right? So being so close to it, the reporter asked him, didn't you think about to have this protest would be dangerous? And they all say no. And they're all, these people are like, I said earlier, those are in their mid-40s to 60s. They are mature people. They are not young students. They have family. So when all of them say they didn't think about it, So it must be true that he really didn't think about this as dangerous. And how is that achieved? So with all this, I put a long story short, I realized this is something very unusual. It's exceptional. And then as I read more of this report, and in one of the reports, a reporter interviewed founder of Falun Gong himself, Mr. Li Hongzhi. And in the interview, Mr. Li Hongzhi claimed that he came from the same spirit as Jesus and Sakyamuni. And he claimed he came to teach people about the cosmos or the universe's principle. And I recall that Bible says 2,000 years later, the vine would come back. But I didn't remember that this teaching said they would come to China. They would come back to China. And Jesus didn't say he came from the same place as Sakyamuni. And so when Mr. Li said he came from the same place, same spirit from Jesus and Sakyamuni, and I said, okay, those three must come from the same place. What is that place? But anyway, so to make a long story short, those are the questions that caused me to think. And this is what I said, you know, a important event for me to rethink all these things. And I don't want to go through the whole thinking process, but it was those, just by reading all those, I digest all those reports, and I realized this is something unusual. I was a scientist. I didn't believe in anything non-scientific. But from this, I realized this is something non-scientific, and I have to believe in it. So I found Falun practitioner and borrowed the textbook, the main text of Falun Gong, Zhang Fengwen, and I read it overnight. I finished and was startled. I was talking to another friend of mine who also read the book, and I said, I cannot understand. And that's what I said. I said, how did the CCP allow Falun Gong to be taught for 7 years to the extent of 100 million people? At that time I already knew that sooner or later the CCP is going to persecute Falun Gong, and I'm going to become one of them to be persecuted. And so at that time I became a Falun Gong practitioner with the understanding. Now the persecution didn't start at that, it hasn't started, but it was with that mental readiness, predicting that the persecution is going to come. I again practice Falun Gong. I guess many people, when they come to Falun Gong, they had no fear. And I was one of them. But what brought me to Falun Gong was this April 25th peaceful demonstration. And later I found out there are many people like me, because before April 25th, Falun Gong is a teaching, remained mainly in China. But because of that, international media report about it, and there are a lot more people know about it. It becomes a global event. And so that is something personal to me. Now, I want to go back to, now I want to go, having covered that, I want to go back to Bill's question. Why? why is the Chinese government so sensitive about it, so, you know, fearful of it? And mainly two reasons. But the most fundamental reason is that the communist dictatorships are not only just a monopoly of power, but it actually dictates people's thought. They want to control everything about you. And they view Marxism or their idea the only truth or only thought that's allowed by people. So they provide all moral guidance, and they have been brainwashing the whole country from actually even before 1949 when they came to power. In their, they control certain regions. In those regions, they have been brainwashing people since 1931 or even, you know, 19, small regions even earlier than that. But when they took over China from 1949, there was this whole country brainwashing. And they have been brainwashing people for, by 1999, exactly half a century. And they thought they were very successful. But then here comes Falun Gong, and 100 million people look towards Falun Gong for their moral guidance. This affronts those dictators. Dictators, and they cannot accept it.
Yeah, when you have 100 million people all on the same page in the opposition, that's more than formidable, I would say. We've got to take another really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Shezong Chen. We're discussing the Falun Gong today, this morning, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm leaving doubt and sorrow in the distance. I'm gonna trust and cast my fears aside. My life's a work that I know you'll finish. I know I'm gonna be alright. It's you I'll chase, even when I can't see your face. No matter how many skies fall down, I'm covered under the peace I've found. You're my shelter.
Dr. Chen, seems like an hour blows by pretty quickly on topics like this. I'll let you continue on with your story, but I do want to know before we close out, I do think Falun Gong is getting bigger rather than smaller, yeah, despite the persecution. Is that correct?
It is getting bigger.
So much for the persecution shutting them down.
It's actually getting bigger from the beginning. Persecution, although it's the most vicious persecution that, you know, we have covered about organ harvesting, but the tide has long turned. There seems to be, throughout its history of ruling China, has never failed a persecution, except this one, the one against Falun Gong. And at the beginning, when it starts its persecution, it was so confident that it claimed it will completely solve the Falun Gong problem, meaning you will eradicate Falun Gong. And Jiang Zemin, the head of CC at that time, was so confident about this that he actually went around the globe carrying with him his pamphlet about, you know, his achievement of persecuting Falun Gong. Later, he would say that international criticism towards China's persecution of Falun Gong is interference in internal affairs. He was the one. He was the one that brought Falun Gong issue to the international society. Anyway, that was how arrogant he was. So, by the first month of persecution, habitually, right, the CCP newspaper claimed that we had achieved a fundamental victory against Falun Gong. 98% of Falun Gong practitioners have been transformed, basically. They've been forced to renounce Falun Gong. Right? But that 98% stayed there forever. I have never seen 98%, 98.1 or 99%, right? And then so each month they would claim they have achieved fundamental victory. But then after a year it becomes strange. How come you have been continually achieving? Talk about it, and soon they found this unattainable or embarrassing position where the more they claim their victory, the more they at the same time, they serve to announce that Falun Gong still stands, still exists. And so, after this first and second year, they have to turn their persecution upside, you know, underground. And so, the tide has turned, and this is the first and only persecution so far that it has failed, and Falun Gong has become stronger. More and more people know about it, and that is actually the power of righteous teaching. And in that sense, the CCP was right that, and I was right when I said, you know, when I first read the book, I said, how did the CCP allow it to spread for 7 years? I meant, what I was thinking is, I was the head of the CCP, but I would have nipped the butt at the first moment. Right? It would be too late. Right? It was too late. And so, but the disease of communism is also at the same time spreading. And this is becoming a global, what started out in 1999, the conflict between goodness and evil, truth and lie, love and hate, has now extended globally. Then this is a historical event that we cannot just think at the level of human activity. I think this is a involvement with a higher realm. Now, what do I mean by higher realm? I think all religion, all faith, involve a higher realm and a lower realm. The lower realm and the middle realm will be human, right? The lower realm will be hell and terrible places. Higher realm will be heaven and beautiful places. And we humans have a choice. to go to the higher room or go to the room, the lower room. And it depends on what path they follow, what teaching they follow. And this is unfolding at the global scale. When we talk about globalization, you know, that's human ingenuity. But evil, goodness, those are global to begin with. And what we're seeing in this country actually reflect or similar, in my eyes, similar to what has been unfolding in China. For a long time, to the United Nations, to my letter to government, to my, you know, in my talk, I have always been saying all the things that the CCP has used against Falun Gong, they would eventually use against all other people. So that was what I said then, but that I was only talking about inside China. Now I must expand that statement to that to global, to the world, to the United States. Let me just use one example, and I'm going to talk about this until the day when this changed. I want to talk about January 6th. I think the people's gathering in Washington, D.C., this is something so righteous that it should be praised. But now it has been demonized, brushed under the carpet. And actually, I didn't have time to talk about the April 10th petition. Was also set up by the CCP. The practitioners went to Beijing to the state petition office. They did not go there to, like, what the international media later say, siege the CCP compound, the headquarters. Anybody go to the CCP headquarters, now stand there, around near there for 10 minutes. Right. Anybody try that? I'm sure if thieves would come by and interrogate you. 10,000 people sieging the CCP headquarters? No. That was set up by the police. They guided all the people to petition to the petition office. They guided them to the CCP headquarters. Right, so it was a setup. The January 6th event in the Congress, right, or what happened in Congress, was also a setup. But unfortunately, this country, I mean U.S., did not, so far, still do not have the courage to write that wrongful claim that people dare to do rioting. I'm going to talk about this until this gets changed. And so it was a setup. I say that was a righteous event, and that the fake media, the wrongful charges that the CCP has used against Falun Gong, now communism around the world are using the same thing against all others that are righteous. So this struggle or conflict between righteous and evil, truth and lie, you know, we have fake media then. Falun Gong practitioner was the first victims of fake media. What happened to them now is happening other places, including this country. And so this is why I say that this is becoming a global event. Mm-hmm. And we will soon, things are happening so quickly that we will soon that where this would go. And Hong Kong will be talked more and more. Very quickly. I guess, Aaron, you didn't know about Falun Gong maybe a few years ago. Now in your program, you start talk about Falun Gong. And right now there are attacks against Falun Gong in CNN, NBC, ABC, and that, right? But I think those attacks against Falun Gong will, in a way, serve as a way to letting more people to know about Falun Gong. And this is contrary to what they intended.
Because you're not allowed to have any type of religious practice in China, correct? The CCP doesn't allow anything. So it isn't like the Falun Gong is flying in the face of the state religion. The state religion is communism.
Right. Yeah. The state religion is communism. It came from not China. It came from Europe. It's not Chinese. And what the thing that the CCP is most afraid of is that Falun Gong actually came from China.
Interesting. A belief from China, yeah. Going against belief that has come into the country from elsewhere. Huh.
Yeah.
It's scary,
yeah.
scary for people who want total control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this is, in a way, this is coming to the United States as well. What is going on in this country are not traditionally here, are not American. These are, again, the political correctness was not what's traditional America.
Yeah, well, it's mirroring what's happened in China with the woke crowd, you know, basically canceling out anybody that doesn't agree with
them.
You've
got to control everything people say. You've got to control everything they think.
You've got to control religion. They're going after all of it.
Yeah, we hope that one day we'll have a program talk about political correctness. Yeah.
Will there be anything to say?
Well, we need to fully disclose what it is, because people still do not know why they call it political correctness. It's political correct, but it's morally wrong.
Yeah, that's a good point. We've called it political correctness for so long, it makes it actually sound like it's a
good thing.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Chen, we've run out of time. Thank you so much for sharing with us, and we're happy to bring light to the issue for the Falun Gong worldwide. So I hope people will go do a little bit of reading. It's important, and it parallels things going on here. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. The second hour, we are going to be talking about the dictatorship of woke capital. Good afternoon, And welcome back to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape Machinery is located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, and they have everything John Deere, from tractors to mowers, implements. They've got it all. Go up and see them. They also handle the Honda product line, so they've got push mowers, generators, all that good stuff, and the steel products, weed trimmers, edgers, chainsaws. They got it all in stock. Go by and see them, or give them a call at 226-9226, or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. There you go. All right.
Bill's trying to turn the tables on me.
Yeah.
Giving me the old dead air point. I like it. Two can play at this game.
Oh, yeah.
Today is April 25th, 2021. Interestingly enough, we just got done speaking with Dr. Shizong Chen regarding the Falun Gong, and I kind of ended the show with, hey, we should do a show about political correctness. So I said to myself, well, there was no time to say it on actual air. We're actually talking about that right now. Because the name of the book that our guest has written is, here we go, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, How Political Correctness Captured Big Business. Imagine that. So good old Dr. Chen, kind of a prophet. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So our guest, Stephen Sokup, we've never talked to him before, but our friend Stephen Manfredi sent him our direction, and that's how we find all these interesting people that we might never meet. Kind of great. I hope you really enjoy it. All these little inserted hour breaks here with people that have written really interesting things, and we hope they get a lot of wide readership. He's the senior commenter, vice president, and publisher of the Political Forum, an independent research provider. Imagine we've never met him before. That just seems wrong. They deliver research and consulting services to the institutional investment community with an emphasis on economic, social, political, and geopolitical events likely to have an impact on the financial markets in the United States and abroad. He's also the director of the Political Forum Institute, a nonprofit educational organization dedicated to creating and preserving community, primarily among those who earn their living and create wealth for the nation through the capital markets. Oh my gosh, we could use more people like this. You know, actually turning this around. He is a frequent media guest who's appeared on major radio, well, like this one, of course, and television programs nationwide. He's and the author of the new book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital. Stephen, where have you been? Every time you turn on the news, there's some company that's done something stupid. I'm assuming that you're telling them to stop doing it?
Yes, in part.
Gosh, I mean, I hope your voice is magnified a million times. Cause
you and me both.
Good Lord. I mean, it's just so distressing to watch our businesses. It's one of those things where before you go buy anything, you almost have to do, it's like, oh, well, I better go look and make sure they haven't done anything bad today because I don't want to give them my money. There's hardly anybody any place to shop anymore. You're going to have to make our own.
I wonder how many people even think about that when they go and buy products anymore.
I don't know.
I'm hoping more and more.
I get a boycott list like every 2 minutes in my email. I don't think people are being all that shy about it. But what prompted this whole thing? Because I'm sure you didn't write the book last week when all this stuff hit the fan. I mean, you've been at this for a while.
I have been at this for a while. I'm very, very fortunate, though, in that my publisher had the wise sense to publish it right at the perfect time.
Yeah.
I have worked in the financial services industry at the nexus of finance and politics for my entire professional career for about 25 years. I started out in the business as a Washington analyst at a big brokerage house, and then moved to another big brokerage house to do the same thing, and found that my voice was being limited. I was not able to tell my clients the truth, to speak important things that I thought they needed to know. And so my boss and I decided that we'd start our own firm. He's now my semi-retired business partner, but we've been in business as independent research providers for 18 years. And over the past decade or so, I've noticed just how dramatically Wall Street has shifted to the political left. This has become a much more significant issue over the past 5 years or so. And so when I started poking around and digging and trying to put my finger on the causes and the explanations and the possible ramifications, it's then that I stumbled upon essentially what we call woke capital, which is the way that our capital markets are essentially governed right now, and the way that business is being pushed further and further to the political left.
I don't know, maybe we just didn't notice it for a long time.
Yeah, when do you think this actually started? I mean, it obviously didn't start last week. They've been kind of lining up for this, or are they just so in tune with public awareness that, you know, they just switched?
Or they've
right
hired
over
so many millennials that are now in charge? I don't know.
Well, I would say this has really been a significant issue since about 2016. The people who are, you know, tacitly in charge of this are not stupid. They are very smart, and they pick their targets very carefully. And one of the targets that they've picked is the state of Georgia. This is not the first time that American big business has targeted Georgia for passing legislation that it disapproves of. In 2016, the state passed a religious freedom bill, which was intended to protect those who objected to same-sex marriage and things like that. And business, big business, descended on the state and threatened the governor that if you sign this law, you will lose a ton of business. He backed down. He vetoed the law, and basically he set the stage for how business would treat Georgia going forward.
And why would business be against that? What's the point?
The point mostly is just to flex its muscle. Most of American business receives pressure from at least one of three sources, and probably all three, and that's pressure from the bottom up, which is workers, as you mentioned, hiring millennials who are woke, who pressure the company to do what they expect them to do politically. Their pressure comes from the top down, which is people in the C-suites who are themselves very arrogant and very confident in their own political beliefs and want to push their companies further and further to the left, and thus they pressure the company. And then a great deal of pressure comes from the outside in, and that comes from activists or activist investors or activist shareholders. And so most of these companies believe that they can do this type of thing, that they can get away with injecting their politics into their business function or using their business to affect politics without any ramifications.
Yeah, because I noticed one of the things you didn't mention was the actual consumer.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The consumer is a secondary or tertiary concern for a lot of these people.
Wow.
But yeah, in 2019, the Georgia legislature passed a fetal heartbeat bill. The bill went to Governor Kemp, who was the new governor at the time, and big business, mostly entertainment companies, led in large part by Bob Iger and Disney, said, hey, and if you want to know how this is, you know, get confused about business and, you know, how laws are bad for business, Bob Iger said, if you pass this law limiting abortion, that will be bad for Disney's business. And so we will have to move our business out of the state. Now, try and make sense of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Governor Kemp pushed back, and he signed the law. Unfortunately, what happened, or fortunately, I guess, you know, for the business leaders, is that law went to court, and so it was thrown out in court. So they never had to follow through on their threats. But they've been targeting Georgia for 5 years, and they target Georgia in large part, I think, because it's an easy state to target. They can lampoon the good old boys and say, oh, look, this is a state with a significant minority population, but these good old white boys are controlling this and pushing them around. So I think that Georgia has been their focus because it's easy for them to lampoon the Republicans in Georgia and to make their stand there.
So it's the It's the investors, the woke workers that are actually putting the pressure on these big companies.
And you would think that that would be pretty easy to say, hey, look, we make shoes or, you know, whatever we make. We're not in the business of
politics, yeah.
Yeah, of policy making.
You would think so, but, you know,
I think it'd be like a short conversation.
I do my usually weekly scan of the news wires to find stories on ESG and sustainability and all of these environmental issues that companies are being pushed toward. And Rolling Stone has a story out yesterday on the 10 best sustainable shoe brands. Companies are being pushed in this direction from everyone. It's not just a passing fad, and it's not just something that comes from one area of our society. It's something that's being pushed on business by a number of different entities, a number of different players who are all pressuring business to make changes to the way they function, which is, you know, a real serious risk to our entire economy.
Well, sure, I would. Now, so you know, we hear all this noise about boycotting. Okay, so you have a consumer base out there that goes, "Hey, wait a minute, we're not going for this. We're not going to buy those products anymore." You think that has an effect on the folks that are actually applying the pressure or to turn it around, or are they just going to weather the storm and wait for people to stop thinking about it and go back to business as usual?
No. I don't think it has any effect whatsoever on them. For example, when Nike pushes Colin Kaepernick out there and has him veto the Betsy Ross flag, they get a lot of pushback from conservative talk radio and Tucker Carlson and a lot of people saying, hey, we hate this. We don't like this. We're going to boycott Nike. But for Nike's target audience, not only is Colin Kaepernick being involved a plus, but the pushback is a plus. So Nike's not hurting from this. Nike, you know, the conservative boycott doesn't hurt Nike at all.
Darn it.
The same goes for Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola goes out there and makes a big deal about the voting rights law in Georgia. And people say, hey, we're not going to buy Coca-Cola. What are your choices? Well, Pepsi. Pepsi's worse. Pepsi is a much more significant and a much more offensive political player than Coca-Cola has been over the past 5 to 10 years. So conservative boycotts have, in general, don't work because people tend to abandon them pretty quickly. Conservatives
right.
have a habit of abandoning the boycotts, but also because it's difficult. I mean, it's hard to find a company that you would choose to give your money to as a consumer that is going to be aligned with your political values at this point.
Yeah. Like, Target was pretty easy to boycott. You know, they kind of, for me, they were one of the early offenders. And I haven't darkened their door in, I don't know, what, 15 years, 20
yes.
years?
Yeah.
I would go to Target if they were the last store on Earth.
Doesn't look like they've been hurt much by it, though. They're still there.
I don't even drive through their parking lot.
Yeah, so it, you know, that begs the question, you know, when you have these woke companies getting involved in politics, you know, obviously the consumer isn't going to have much to say about it. What is the kickback on that? What do you do?
Well, I think that what anybody, not just conservatives, but anybody who objects to the political weaponization of capital or the weaponization of business for political purposes, what they should do is to look at what the left has done and reverse engineer what they've done and make that sort of a focus on pushing companies back the other direction. And what I mean by that mostly is that the left has been the squeaky wheel for the past 10, 15, 20 years in American business, and they've gotten greased. What consumers, what investors, what independents and conservatives need to do is to push back. They need to squeak a little bit as well.
I think people are getting to that point where it's like,
oh, yeah.
they're really starting to flail. Like, all right, we got to figure something out. We have to take a really quick break. Speaking of consumerism. We're a little advertising break here. We'll be right back. Our guest is Stephen Sokup. He has written a book about woke capital. Imagine that, how political correctness captured big business. And I do think that if this is a new idea for you, you should listen to our show more often. You can find 10 years of archives to catch you up on what's been going on in the world, I guess, at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Of Old Glory, and awake in the dawn's early light. But much to my surprise, when I opened my eyes, I was a victim of the Great Compromise.
Hey, so Stephen, Your lovely publicist, he always sends me a list of questions, which, you know, I'm not very good at taking directions, so I promptly disregard. But I did look at them during the break. And, you know, for people who maybe aren't speaking the lingo of today's modern, you know, all this vernacular, define woke capital for people. That actually was a really good question. I should not have disregarded.
Well, the way in which I define woke capital is that it's a it's an anti-democratic, top-down strategy being used by some of the biggest and best-known names in American business to change the way business functions, to change the definition of capitalism, and most importantly, to change the relationship between the citizens and the state permanently.
Mm. Okay, so it's a cultural, basically a cultural movement.
Very much so.
Okay,
and then he has on here, what is the ESG movement? And actually, I don't know what that is either.
Okay, ESG stands for environmental, social, and corporate governance investing, and that's probably the hottest trend there is in the investment world in North America and in Europe, and has been for the past couple of years. Literally tens of billions of dollars every year being dumped into this movement.
Which, the green blackmail.
Yes, it pushes corporations to embrace strategies for planning for a zero carbon future and strategies planning for very superficial definitions of diversity being mandated upon them. And it pushes for a whole host of issues that are almost strictly political, but has chosen to inject them into the financial services world, into our capital markets, into the way our businesses are financed.
That makes sense. I mean, it sucks, but it makes sense.
Right.
So Bill had a thought during the break about, like, targeting.
Yeah, I heard. I don't know who it was. I was listening to somebody, one of the famous talking heads last week, and they were talking about the boycotting of these major corporations. And their theory was, don't go out and boycott 15 big corporations all at the same time because it's ineffective and it won't work. They were saying. People need to boycott one particular corporation until it has an effect on them. And then once that happens, the rest of them will look at that and go, hey, they kind of ganged up on Coca-Cola or whatever. I don't want that to happen to me. Do you think that's a valid point?
It's a half-valid point.
Okay.
It's similar to a strategy that I personally advocate myself. Instead of boycotting, I advocate engaging. Engage with the company. that's how the left has gotten the greases, the squeaky wheel, by engaging them. But that said, if we were to, say, target one company and found all of the conservative or apolitical shareholders in that company to target one member of the board of directors, and we went to the annual general meeting or attended the annual general meeting online and voted our shares to remove that director, that would be an enormous message. Most efforts to remove a director from a board of directors gets like 1 or 2% positive votes. They're almost always retained with huge margins. But if we all focused on one company and one director and targeted them and said, hey, look, this is how we're going to engage. This director is a problem because they won't rein in the CEO who is pushing politics instead of business, then we could have a very, very serious impact. Then that director becomes, you know, the man in the cement shoes who gets thrown into the, you know,
right.
who's the warning to everybody else that this is, we're coming after you in the way that they have come after you. We're going to target you where it hurts. And I think that that would be a much more effective strategy by engaging with the companies. Because if we boycott, then we'd leave the playing field. Then we'd leave the field to those who would use capital markets for political reasons. And so I don't believe in boycotting, not just because of the effectiveness, but because it leaves the playing field open for those who have nefarious plans.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I think engaging, but at the same time focusing, would be a fantastic idea. The question is, how do you organize that? How do you put that together? Things
right.
like that. But I like I said, I think that's a half right strategy.
Yeah. Has boycotting ever worked? I mean, I can't think of any situation where, you know, it may have had an immediate effect, but not a long lasting effect.
No, I don't think that. Certainly, on the conservative side, I don't think that any conservative boycotts have ever worked. I know that there was a lot of initial celebration about Dick's Sporting Goods when Dick's sort of unilaterally said we're not going to sell guns anymore because of what happened at, you know, in Florida with the high school shooting, and conservatives said, well, we'll just boycott, and Dick's lost money over the next quarter and I believe over the next year, but that didn't hold, and Dick's is still just fine, and nobody even remembers for the most part that
right.
was ever even an issue.
Right. Yeah, that's what I've always experienced with boycotts, is they make a lot of noise for a little while, and then people go back to business as usual.
I don't think people really do it, though. That's my take. I think people are a little bit on the weak-willed side, and I don't think they necessarily stick with it. But I do get your point, because the other guys are really, really vocal, and I'm not sure that conservatives are organized in a way to go lean on companies necessarily.
Right. If you take, for example, you know, we were just talking about the definition of ESG. If you were to take the three biggest passive asset management firms in this country, they're BlackRock, which has about $9 trillion in assets under management, Vanguard, which has about $7 trillion, and State Street that has about $5 trillion. So together, they control about $20 trillion in ETFs, so in passive funds, which means that they have usurped for themselves the shareholder voting rights of all that $20 trillion. And what they have done, all three of these companies have said that even their non-ESG funds are going to be aligned with ESG values, particularly sustainability. So now we have these three corporations which hold, you know, that $20 trillion amounts to about 18 to 28% of every single company on the S&P 500.
Wow.
So now we're starting at, at least a 20 to 25% deficit of companies that are pushing politics from the left on corporations. And so we have to make up that difference. We have to sustain some sort of organization to push back on that, starting at such a deficit, because that's the way that they have organized the game, and that's how late we are to the game and how far behind we are in it.
Hmm. Just sad. Just having a moment of sadness here.
Well, you know, it's funny because
it's just crazy. How did this happen?
You know, what limited knowledge I have of business, I think you have to make sales. That's the lifeblood of your business is your bottom line. You've got to sell product. And if you don't sell product, then your share price is going to go down. Everything's going to go down. But it's sad that the actual consumer has so little impact on that.
Yeah, it is sad, but that's the way that American business is at this point, where investors, particularly large institutional and passive investors, are among their biggest clientele. The irony is that the ESG movement is virtually interchangeable with what they call the stakeholder model of business, or the stakeholder economic model, which claims that business exists to support all sorts of different stakeholders, not just the shareholders, that it's supposed to be there to support the environment and the workers and the consumers and, you know, whole different host of people. And that's what the ESG claims to be after, and yet the shareholders, the large shareholders are the ones who are benefiting, while the consumers are the ones who essentially get the shaft in the whole thing.
Sure.
Well, pulling out of these, you know, they're moving their companies out of certain states and different things like that. I mean, I'm curious. It would seem like the cost benefit wouldn't bear that out. You know, this moving of offices and people and all that, just because of their politics.
Well, I don't think it probably does, and I don't think we've seen any companies do that necessarily. You probably have seen quite a few move from California to Texas for opposite reasons, because in California...
Yeah, that's going to benefit them huge.
Exactly. But that's one where there's a tangible benefit to them. But, you know, for example, Bob Iger talked a big game about moving business out of Georgia, and yet he never did. I think it's mostly threats that come from a lot of these companies about moving business out. Now some of the threats, like Major League Baseball, can follow through on a threat, and the NCAA can follow through on threats, and things like that. But most major business, you know, they have sunk costs in those states, which means that for the most part, they're just flapping their gums and trying to convince people that they're going to do something that they're not.
Mm. Right.
Yeah, because that's true. I didn't go back and check. You know, I didn't look and make sure their address changed.
Well, yeah, but you look at companies like United and Coca-Cola. I mean, they're not moving out of Georgia.
No, well, it's everywhere.
Yeah.
From the inside looking out, the people that work in that system, are they... not necessarily for the specific companies, but in an industry like yours that sort of deals with a broad base of companies. Are people frustrated with this, or do they, I mean, is this just the new normal and they're fine with it?
I think you probably get about half and half. Some who think that this is fantastic and that this is the way that we can all have business reflect our values and that there's no downside to it. And then there are others who look to the future and see that eventually the Fed's going to have to stop printing money and businesses are going to have to start earning business again, and stock shares are going to drop of companies that don't focus on business and are concerned at the way that this is going to change the way business functions and whether or not it's going to American business is going to continue to be the engine of economic growth in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a scary thought.
Yeah, it's a very scary thought.
Yeah, because we've always really felt that the rise and fall of our country was on the exercise of free market, and now it seems like the free market has to go through the tunnel of political correctness before they can come out and. be
play
the,
ball,
and
yeah.
be the free market, which yeah. at that point they're not. They're like the hostage market.
It's not just the tunnel of political correctness, but it's a tunnel of political correctness and arrogance coupled with Gnosticism, coupled with hypocrisy. Because yeah. all you know, the irony in all of this is that all of these companies, these very woke companies, be they asset management firms or consumer firms or electronic firms, they're all also very heavily invested in the People's Republic of China.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Apple is the wokest company in the world, and I just saw a thing about how they have created a new $300 million sustainability fund in this country. And yet, at the same time, Apple is virtually tied at the hip to the Chinese Communist Party. What's good for Apple is good for the Chinese Communist Party, and what's good for the Chinese Communist Party is good for Apple. And so the hypocrisy here is very rank, and it's you know, it belies the fact that these woke CEOs have you know, a great deal of unwarranted arrogance in their own abilities to control somebody like, you know, Xi Jinping.
Yeah, right.
Which is something that I think they're mistaken about.
Right.
Well,
right.
It's interesting because the all of the you know, the idiotic green stuff, most of those things are going to price, I mean, a lot of what these companies do, out of business. They're going to wake up one day and say, oh, gosh, that, you know, might not have been our best decision going all green on this, that, and the other. I think it's incredibly expensive and doesn't actually accomplish what they want. Nobody seems to be concerned that eventually the noose gets so tight that it just strangles them out.
Well, you know, the fun thing about Apple is that it's been a leader in this part of consumer advertising. Hey, look, we're green. We're entirely carbon neutral. Our whole company produces zero carbon emissions, which is absolutely 100% true. Apple Corporation is a zero carbon company, and they can proudly brag about that when they sell their products. Catch is that the overwhelming majority of the energy used to design, create, manufacture, and distribute Apple products is not used by Apple, but is used by the contractors that they hire that are based in Taiwan and the People's Republic of China, which either are not green or lie about it, and for the most part are using coal to create the Apple products. So Apple has this basically greenwashing scam going, where it is in fact the greenest company in the country, but that has nothing to do with their products.
Right.
And I like the greenwashing.
Yeah, that would explain why, in spite of what's going on with the CCP and the public perception of you know, China's big and bad and blah blah blah, has very little impact on Apple.
Apple doesn't really care. No, people are really hooked on that. I hate them too. Wouldn't darken their door either. I'm kind of a hater.
Yeah.
It's Sunday, I can confess.
They give you reason, though, for it.
They have, always, from the very beginning. First of all, they had little pictures on their phone, and I thought, you know, I'm not five. I'd like words, please. don't make me operate a device with little pictures. That just irritated me to the core. It still makes me angry just thinking about it. That's sad. Okay, we have to take a really quick break, not because of my anger issue.
Yeah, I'll calm her down on the break.
I don't have
here.
Any mean songs about Apple, or I'd play them right now, just pretend. You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got minds to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no
for good.
There, I knew I'd find a song for Apple. Stephen. So there seems to be no way out of this. Is that kind of true, or are we just going through the darkness?
I'm sorry?
I said, or are we just going through a dark time?
Well, I think, yes, we are going through a dark time. And, in fact, it's much darker than I thought it would be, in large part because either President Biden or those who are pulling the strings behind the curtain have been very aggressive about politicizing the financial bureaucracy, particularly the SEC and the Federal Reserve, that had traditionally been acknowledged by both parties to be beyond politics. And so I'm very concerned about that. But at the same time, I do think that there are ways around this, and that there are ways to push back. There's a long-term strategy. In the book, I talk about how a lot of this is the result of the cultural left's very aggressive, century-long attempt to take the institutions, and we have to take them back. So that will take several years and decades, but I think it can be done. And the short-term strategy, I think, is to take back what is ours. And by that, I mean when we spend our consumer dollars, expect the company to understand what we're upset about if they do something wrong. Call customer service. Call them and complain. Say, hey, look, I'm buying this, but I want you to understand, you know, record this and send it to your supervisor. I want you to understand that I'm offended by X, Y, and Z. Likewise, in investing, take back what is yours. Take back control of your shareholder rights if that's possible. If it's not invested in a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund, and if it is invested in those kinds of funds, move it to a manager who will at least take some sort of input from you rather than simply invest it based on your beliefs or on their political beliefs, pardon me. And so there are ways to push back. Engagement, engagement, engagement. If customer service hates getting calls from people complaining, I can guarantee you investor relations hates it more. Show up to the virtual annual general meetings of companies. Ask questions. Make it difficult for them. I think if we do this type of thing, as I said, to reverse engineer what the left has done and to be squeaky, maybe even squeakier than they have been, then I think that we can make some headway at least.
That's good. Outlook on it. I mean, it isn't just wait till the tide changes. Do you ever deal with CalPERS?
I know CalPERS. I know how important they are. I know how infected with ESG and with wokeness.
Because they stopped investing in fossil fuels, firearms. I mean, it was a list of things that are all extraordinarily profitable. And, imagine that. Their portfolio went way down. And I thought, even for their investors, they're willing to take a hit just to... I mean, that seems odd to me. Are you seeing that a lot?
Well, you know, the funny thing about CalPERS is they made such a production of getting out of those companies, and yet we're still in... You know, I think it was at the time 371 companies that were connected to the Chinese government, including armament manufacturers in the Chinese government. So, CalPERS has like
everyone
else. So
we just hate Smith and Wesson, but we don't hate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
they have different perspectives on what's politically correct here and what's politically correct across the Pacific Ocean, but. The investors in CalPERS are the taxpayers of California.
Right.
If your city's police pension is invested with CalPERS, and they're taking less, or they're getting less a return because of their moral beliefs, that difference is going to have to be made up either by the retirees who get shafted on their pension, or by the taxpayers who are going to have to make up the difference. So, CalPERS can preach all it wants, but, there's no downside for the people at CalPERS so much as there's downside for everybody else in the state.
Is there a
any ability to target like the CalPERS managers, like you were talking about earlier? I mean, is that something people can do?
I'm not sure how CalPERS is set up, but I would think that that's going to have to come from the legislature, probably. Which makes it all the more difficult.
Never going to happen in California.
We're out here in the fully captured zone.
Yes. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, that is a black mark on the record. So what have we missed? What else can people look forward to in your book that we probably aren't hearing about?
Probably the most important thing to understand is that this trend of businesses involving themselves in politics, investors, large asset management firms involving themselves in politics, that this is specifically and intentionally anti-democratic. The first half of my book traces the history, and I just mentioned one history, the takeover of the institutions, but the other history starts in 1876 in Baltimore at the newly formed Johns Hopkins University, where Richard Ely, who's one of the godfathers of American progressivism, is a professor of political economics, and one of his students is Woodrow Wilson, one of the other godfathers of progressivism. Together they formulate the idea that Americans are simply too selfish, too stupid, too poorly educated to govern themselves and need this guardian class, this professional ruling class to take care of them. And then that has been a guiding principle in American progressivism ever since. And so we've had a professional bureaucracy, and then they tried to manipulate the judiciary, and now they're trying to manipulate business to be a break against the will of the people. That's the thing to understand, is when these businesses get upset with Georgia, they're getting upset with the duly elected representatives and the duly elected governor of Georgia. They're saying, we don't believe in the way this country is supposed to function, because we don't trust the people, and we think the people are wrong, and we want to change that. The most important thing to remember is that this is anti-democratic, and this has been part of the ruling class statist leftist strategy in this country for 150 years.
That does make a lot of sense, though. It is, any time people rise up, well, we demonize them, for one. You know, they're same things that you listed. You know, they're uneducated, they're backward, whatever. And if they just understood the big picture, then they would be able to speak this language. But they can never connect the dots. And the only way they ever move their agenda down the field is with force.
Right.
So if it was that great, I mean, people would want to do it, but they don't.
Right, yeah. And that's the bureaucracy was designed in this country specifically to guide the will of the people. And then, as I said, they used the judiciary. You know, it was legislation by judicial fiat in this country for probably the 1950s. To the 1990s, and now this is their next step in how they plan to step around the will of the people in order to get what they want, what they believe is necessary politically, but the people are not smart enough to vote for. So this is very, you know, very anti-democratic.
Right. Do you think the big money in politics today? Obviously, it's having an impact on our elections. But you know, when these politicians get into office, they have to raise money to stay in office.
Yep.
And these are the folks that are kind of dictating the direction of things, which ultimately means the corporations are dictating the direction of things.
Yeah, as much as they contribute.
Yeah. Yeah, because they don't want to lose that contribution.
Yeah, what are you hearing on the elected side? Are people
there have been a handful of positive reactions from elected representatives. In 2019, for example, when Disney and Universal and Paramount all got upset about George's abortion bill, Senator Cotton in Arkansas took notice and took to the floor of the Senate and gave a stemwinder of a speech, basically accusing them of trying to usurp the power of the people, which is, in fact, what they were doing. The problem is that the narrow focus of elected representatives tends to make it difficult to explain to them or to get them to focus on just how pervasive and how widespread and how many different facets there are to this infiltration of American business. It's not something that can be addressed really by somebody who's got to be as narrow and focused as a senator or a congressman or even a governor. It's going to take quite a bit of organization and push from regular investors and from regular consumers and voters.
Hmm. Yeah, I just think it just seems like every time you wake up, there's some other company that's jumped on the bandwagon with some dummy like Colin Kaepernick, and they've decided to make this him their poster boy. Has that really worked out for them in your, since you've actually looked at it a lot more than the rest of us? It just seems like that would be not a benefit, but I guess it's got to be working or they'd quit doing it.
Yeah, well, I think that he's been so valuable to Nike, and it's allowed them to connect with a consumer. It's allowed them to solidify their connection with the millennial and Gen Z consumers, in that it essentially proves their non-conformist bona fides.
Right.
It makes them the real deal as far as they're concerned with woke politics.
Right. Well, they you know, these big companies have always kind of been in the bag on the progressive side. But it seems like lately they're much more vocal about it. Now they're coming out of the closet and really getting in everybody's face about their position, which really kind of surprises me.
Well, I mean, they started out with, you know, there are subtle things like animal crackers, you know. I mean, most of us that are old, we remember animal crackers, and they were in a little box and they had a string, and you know, the animals were like, it was like a little
train car with a cage.
Yeah, where the animals went to the zoo or the circus. And obviously, we don't have any of that anymore. Now they're out on the Serengeti.
They let them out of the circus.
Killed the circus. So that's gone. Now we got to put them out in the Serengeti. So animal crackers live in the Serengeti. But there's little stuff like that. It's kind of everywhere when you really start looking. So for people who think this is limited to Nike, I think you should take a look at your products.
Yeah, in the introduction of the book, I refer to this as the old cliche of the onion. When I started digging into this, I'd peel a layer, and I'd find another layer, and then I'd peel that layer and find another layer, and over and over and over again. It's so widespread and so ingrained and so it's just so pervasive. It's hard to get your head around it.
Hard to run away from it fast enough. So thank you so much for being on with us. We have run out of time, but I hope people will go get the book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital. Author is Stephen Soukup, spelled S-O-U-K-U-P, and you can find all that info at wethepeopleradio.us.